Hi, I'm Taylor Smurl.
And I'm Liz June.
And this is
Neat.
It's a weekly boozecast.
It's a history lesson with a twist.
There it is. That's the intro.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello. This is the pandemic edition where all of our episodes are twice as long and you hear a little bit about our cats.
You might start hearing from the cats soon. I don't know. I can't believe it. I mean, I don't know. My cat's digging this, though. I'm home all the time. As soon as he finishes the last bite of food in his bowl, he can find me and demand a new one, and I give it to him because I'm a service industry veteran. I need to feel like I'm needed and I'm providing for other things. So I'm like, oh, right away, sir. I'll get right on that. Thank you very much. Are you done with this dish?
That's
very, very prompt service here at Chateau Jack.
Yes.
I don't know why the restaurant's named after my one customer.
Yeah. He deserves it. Yep. He earned it. Yep. I made a whole like oasis on my fire escape. I know I told you that I made my fire escape into an emotional escape, but I don't know if I mentioned that I bought AstroTurf mats to put on it. They were pretty cheap. It just so happened that two of them fit the exact like dimensions of it. So yeah, now there's fake grass for Luna to enjoy.
I love that.
She's into it.
Little teeny fake soccer matches.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yes.
Yeah, that's what you do on AstroTurf. What? Yeah. Well, you know, we're doing our best. We're trying to get a somewhat normalized production schedule. Trying is the operative word there.
Yeah, you know, it's just, we got to keep you on your toes. You don't know what to expect. Is the episode going to come out on Monday? Is it going to come out on Friday? Who knows? It's when I finish editing it. That's when.
I mean, look, I see all y'all out there tweeting about how you don't know if it's Monday or Thursday anymore.
Right?
So what? Maybe what you're listening to this on the release day. Maybe.
Yes.
What is day? I don't know. Days?
It's
there is just night and
Fry
day.
Tuesday. Yeah.
There was before and after I fed the cat. That's it. That's two times. That's all there are.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Ooh. I bet you don't know what day it is right now, listener.
I know. Well, and we can't tell you because I don't know when you're listening to this.
But, don't know. We don't know either. We don't know either.
We are going to, hopefully by the time you listen to this, we have announced when we're going to be getting back on track with videos. We're going to be switching to a live format so we can interact with each other and also entertain you and you can interact with us. It'll be a whole thing.
That'll be exciting.
Hopefully, if you're listening to this, you're like, "Yeah, we know," or "We already did that." Maybe.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe we've already done it. Again, what is time?
I know. It's a multiverse.
It's the future. It's the past.
None of it is anything. All right. But hey, you know what? Look, the world's a scary place right now. Let's just take a little, we can't really go places actually, so we're going to take a little trip of the mind. Is that a good way? Is that a good segue here?
Yes. Okay. Yes. We are mentally traveling psychically to Brazil this week for some drinks. Just for some drinks, you know.
Yes.
So one of our patrons actually on Patreon, our patron Ryan asked about cachaça, and I think some other people might have mentioned it before via tweets and comments on our YouTube So we just wanted to talk about cachaça. It's a pretty cool thing. What's the deal with cachaça? It is the national beverage of Brazil, and it is produced both industrially and artisanally. It's like a fruity, spicy, sweet, mainly clear spirit made from fermented sugarcane juice and often aged in indigenous Brazilian wood barrels. Cachaça has a lot of regulations. It's got a lot of rules. So in order to be cachaça by law, it has to be made in Brazil and have a ABV of 38% to 48%. Brazil actually makes 800 million liters of cachaça annually. That's a lot.
It's a lot of cachaça.
Yeah,
a lot of people drinking cachaça.
Yeah, it's got to be, right? It used to commonly be referred to as Brazilian rum. Some people still kind of refer to it as that. And it sometimes was even labeled as Brazilian rum that way in the U.S. But as of 2013, Brazilian government got involved and got a whole agreement dealy with the U.S. and established that it can only be labeled as cachaça. So they got that branding on point now.
And it's worth noting that that rum comparison is, it makes sense. I mean, yeah, like cachaça is distilled from sugarcane.
Right. It's very different from rum.
Well, it's not necessarily actually, because rum can be distilled from traditionally, we always think molasses for rum,
right,
and that's true.
That's what I was thinking.
But rum can also be made from, sometimes it's made from sugarcane syrup. In the case of Rum Agricole, if you've ever seen their rum with the H, that's Rum Agricole. Mm. And also sometimes called French style rum. So we're just going to bring France into this conversation.
Why not?
but that is made from fresh pressed sugarcane juice and is very similar to cachaça. So I do think that delineation of it has to be made in Brazil is important, because there is a style of rum that is incredibly similar to cachaça. It's made in practically the same way.
Right. Basically, the only difference is that Brazil is like, oh, no, you can't call that cachaça because it wasn't made here.
Exactly.
And also, cachaça tends to taste a little bit gentler than rum agricole. Like, it has a less, like, that kind of what we think of like as a strong spirit. Like, it's supposed to be a little bit milder. That's, I don't know what you consider mild in like a in a distilled spirit that's like 40% ABV. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think that comes down to just sort of like the palate of cachaça in Brazil. It's typically they in the artisanal field, they go for something that's more refined, or it's less refined, actually. It is.
Yeah, well, there's different classifications of it too, and there's so many things as part of like the process of making different types of cachaça that it can all be very different. They all like, depending upon the various indigenous Brazilian wood barrels that it can be aged in, they all impart different flavors and characteristics. And they do sometimes even use non-native oak barrels, but the distinction is like, whereas like cachaça can be made in oak barrels, you can't use Brazilian wood to age anything but cachaça. They won't. Right. That's another one of those regulations. Like, it's not that it can't be done, but it's not allowed to be done.
One brand that does, if you're curious about encountering any of those various indigenous wood finishes on cachaça, along with, they also have an oak, I'm pretty sure, is Avoir Cachaça. Spelled A-V-U-A, and they have, it's one of my favorite kinds of cachaça. It's pretty widely available in America now, and they have, like, a whole line of indigenous woods that they use, and they have a great, like, reclamation program, like, environmental program. So
nice.
It is cool to see the kind of, a lot of times you're dealing with the same base spirit, but different ages on the same spirit, and just seeing how radically different they all taste, just based on how they were aged in what wood.
Oh, yeah. Like, some of them have, like, more of the baking spices, like vanilla and cinnamon. Some of them have, like, clove and anise. And a lot of research has been done to map those aromas. Somebody was very much into mapping these aromas to try to, kind of with the intent of proving that using the indigenous wood gives it more of the soul of Brazil. I don't know how you can prove that a spirit has the soul of a country, but that's what they were into, and they found over 70 different aromas.
I mean, I will say, because it's funny, in the bar world, it's nothing new. I think that people have known the cachaça for a while now, but it does scare people away on menus. I think people see it and like, I don't know what that is. I've even worked at bars that have called it rum to get it to sell.
Oh, yeah.
But as far as like, if you're like, well, would I like it or would I not? I mean, it's a beautiful, nuanced spirit. It's so cool. It's like Liz said, it can be so many different things. So right. It's really just, it's a whole category. It's the same as when we talk about whiskey and say, look at all that whiskey can be, or rum. Rum can be so many things. Yeah. Cachaça is just, it's the exact same world where there's so much nuance and there's so much like flavor and just cool earthy. To me, it's always very like grassy and like banana. It has like a little bit of the funk that you get off of like some rums, but it's a lot softer. It's a lot more velvety. I don't know.
Give me that funk. That's
I love that. Cachaça. It's good.
Good.
And I dig that, like that terroir concept. I've talked about it before. You've made fun of me for that word, but like terroir. What grows together goes together, you know, like I think if you're gonna, you know, like aging a spirit that's grown from the same ground as the wood that you're aging it in, like that's I think that's just like a base understanding in like the culinary arts, that you're probably there's something there in the soil that's gonna make things work together. I don't know.
Right. And there's like, I mean, the aging process also has obviously imparts more characteristics to it. You don't have to store it in wood barrels after distillation. And that's what there's like the classification Branca, or basically white cachaça, is either one of two things. Either it's just not stored in wood barrels after it's distilled, or it's stored in wood barrels that don't impart color into the spirit, like peanut wood doesn't impart any color. And it's all, that's like that can, you can also call that classica or tradicional, or prata, which means silver, kind of like what we like the classifications that you give to tequila, like silver, gold. And they have and then the next one would be you store it in wood barrels that do impart color, and that would be, it's called amarella, or that just means yellow, or sometimes they call it oro, which means gold. Then you have the aged classifications, and you have premium and extra premium. Premium is you have to age it for at least 1 year, and extra premium is more than 3 years. So it's like this very similar to different styles of like, whiskey, tequila, mezcal, like, you know, the aging process definitely, just like any other spirit, makes for a different kind of viscosity and characteristics.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the origin. Should we do that next?
So let's, where did a cachaça come from?
Yeah, so the origin of cachaça is very much intertwined with Brazil's history of slavery, very much like when we talked about rum. In the United States, it's intertwined with Brazil's history of slavery and colonization by Portugal. So in the 1500s, the Portuguese brought both sugarcane and enslaved African captives to Brazil for the purpose of milling and refining sugar. And we actually get the word cachaça from that. The Africans called the foam that collected at the top of the sugar cauldrons cachaça. And supposedly they were also the first ones to ferment it and drink it. And it became part of their daily rations even before the Portuguese colonists decided to distill it. Mm-hmm. And the distillation kind of came out of necessity because Brazil made so much goddamn sugar. So they had to do something with it. They didn't really have like this was like before they had like a great way of refining sugar. So we didn't really, like, molasses was really crude. Like, we didn't really want to do anything with that. And then the sugarcane juice itself spoils really easily. That makes it pretty hard to export that. It's going to spoil. So rather than letting it to go to waste, they began distilling it. And that made the Brazil's national beverage. I mean, after that, sugar production kind of shifted to the Caribbean because they did figure out how to make molasses. and like rum became a huge thing. Rum became the spirit that was like super easy to transport, and everybody who was involved in all of that production, rum was the thing. So cachaça actually never really made it out of Brazil and remained pretty isolated in Brazil.
Well, and it has that same moment of kind of origin that we have with with our Applejack and our whiskey in America, where there was the taxation that the colonies were getting in Brazil was so high that it made sense just to, here, we already have this left over. Let's make this and drink this here versus importing, you know, brandy, which was the thing that the Portuguese were drinking at the time, like brandy and port. Instead of importing those, let's just make our own stuff because it's cheaper and these taxations are biting us in the ass, the same way that American colonists did.
That's right.
So the, like, wealthy class, their fondness of cachaça grew to such an extent that the Portuguese actually legislated against it. They actually banned the consumption of it on June 12th, 1744. That it now that's recognized as National Cachaça Day. But basically, they didn't want the competition. Against what they could sell people in Brazil, and that didn't actually really diminish its popularity. Cachaça just kind of became an icon in, like, national solidarity. Of, like, you know, this is our identity. And that hope of colonial revolution in the 1800s definitely stayed in Brazil, but became important to the spirit of Brazil.
Yeah, it was like a symbol of fuck the, I don't know. Yeah.
Also, fun fact, and
fuck,
I don't,
the establishment. That's fuck, what I'm trying to say.
Fuck the establishment. Also, all of our turkeys are wasted.
Oh, shit. Talk more about that, please.
This is the one random fact that I found in my end of the research, that they like to feed their turkeys, force feed their turkeys cachaça to get them drunk because they thought it tasted better. I mean, this is not like, we talk about culinary arts. This isn't some, like, crazy notion, like, what you put in an animal will affect the flavor of it.
Yeah.
Also, like, and I mean, you also, like, more relaxed animals. Right. They don't release the, like, the chemicals, the stress that can flavor the meat. So, yeah, I mean, they were drinking cachaça as a populace, but they were also getting their turkeys drunk, so...
I mean, I guess that's a good, if you're a turkey and you're gonna go, that's probably a better way to go. I don't know. Would you want to? I think if I were a turkey, I'd want to be drunk.
Yeah, I mean, if I was gonna be slaughtered and consumed, I would hope to be inebriated.
All right, this got a little bit dark. Let's move on now.
Right. Well, okay, so what can you do with cachaça? You can serve it to your turkey. If they want it, only if.
Get consent first.
Right?
It's very important.
Any conversation of cachaça naturally drifts to the caipirinha, which is the cocktail that is most iconically linked with cachaça.
And it's delicious.
It is so delicious.
And so simple.
It is. It's really, I love it because it's really about how you make it is where the beauty of the caipirinha comes from, because the ingredients themselves look like so many other drinks. But we're going to talk about the methodology, but I think you've got a little bit of the history that you might want to...
Oh, yeah. So it kind of has a little bit of an evolution, because there is one account that claims it was actually invented in Alentejo, Portugal, in 1918 as a treatment for... the Spanish flu, which you maybe wouldn't have been familiar with, except for it's very topical now.
Yeah, I've had a lot of Twitter dissertation around the Spanish flu in the last, you wouldn't think, but here we are.
Here we are. And the recipe for that included lemon, garlic, and honey, and cachaça. And that tonic is actually still used to supposedly treat the common cold. I mean, the first thing I thought when I saw, like, lemon, honey, garlic was, like, my artist friends who are singers and stuff. It's supposed to be, like, like, it's soothing to your throat. It also is supposed to, like, kind of open up your sinuses. Like, that's, like, a swear-by remedy for, as, like, a tea.
Yeah, there are things in garlic and honey and citrus that are aiding to the immune system.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Nothing wrong with that.
It's not bad for you.
It doesn't take the place of a doctor, but yeah.
Right. Still go to the doctor, but it won't hurt. And it makes you feel good. I guess. I always like feel when I eat a lot of garlic, I feel like I'm like getting clearing out my sinuses.
Yeah.
There's that account. There's also another account that it was made by landowning farmers in Piracicaba. This is what historians like to go with, that it was made in a rural area just outside of Sao Paulo during the 19th century. So, and that would kind of make sense because the word caipirinha comes from caipira. In Brazilian Portuguese, it refers to someone from the countryside. It sounds nice because it's not English, but it basically means hillbilly.
This makes me want to make a caipirinha with like Kentucky bourbon and just call it the hillbilly, and then I will be appropriate.
But you can't call it a caipirinha because it doesn't have cachaça in it, right?
No, I'll just call it a hillbilly.
Okay, yeah, all right.
I'm from the Appalachian region. I think I can do that. I don't know. I don't want to offend anybody.
Yeah, no, but I mean, regardless of where it came from, if there was lemon and garlic and honey in it, eventually they switched the recipe for something a little bit more palatable, and they went with just muddled lime juice and sugar topped with cachaça, which is pretty dang tasty. But Brazilians are pretty particular about how you do that, and I think you have a little bit more on the methods for us.
Yeah. I mean, the old school traditional way of making a caipirinha is you're actually using whole lime pieces or lime wedges. So you're actually like cutting down half a lime, putting that in the bottom of your glass, glass you're going to drink it out of, and then you're putting like a couple teaspoons of sugar on top of that and muddling that into your slurry of like sugar and citrus. So the lime juice is breaking down the sugar, but the other kind of important thing that sets this drink apart, when you hear lime, sugar, base spirit, you think, oh, it's a sour build or it's a daiquiri play, like something like that. It's very similar to so many drinks. But the thing that sets it apart for me is that when you're muddling those lime pieces, you're also getting the oil from the peel.
Ah, like the essence.
Mm-hmm. Like it's just, lime. You know, And the peel, the pith, the oil, that imparts a very distinct aromatic and flavor quality to the drink. And then traditionally you just put some ice in the glass and like you keep all the muddled limes in the bottom. Everything stays in the glass. Just throw some ice in and put the cachaça on top, kind of give it a stir, and that's your drink.
Nice. Simple.
Yeah. And it's, you know, no shaker, no nothing. And you know, you'll see people like make caipirinhas. They'll call them caipirinhas. They'll use fresh lime juice and simple syrup and cachaça in a shaker. And I just think that is a cachaça sour or cachaça daiquiri to me. Like that, it's, you gotta have the muddled lime oils in there.
Yeah, and it's also traditional. It's part of the tradition of drinking a caipirinha and drinking cachaça.
Yeah, and I mean, it also just adds a technique. Like it's a really cool way. If there's a drink that you like that involves lemon or lime juice, try it with muddling the whole fruit versus using the juice, and you can really see that it adds a really cool different level or layer to any kind of basic ass boring sour build. So
nice.
Yeah, really beautiful, really simple, really specific drink. The way to properly make a caipirinha is so important to Brazilians that in 2008 there were actually Brazilian laws established to dictate that a caipirinha has to consist solely of lime, sugar, and cachaça to bear that name. There were a lot of drinks that were being made at the time that would sub out the lime, that would put in, you know, kiwis or strawberries or passion fruit, which, to be fair, that all sounds delicious. But they really wanted to create an identity for this one drink, which I think is really smart. It's smart on an international stage to create that drink identity. And all that other stuff that had all the other fruit in it was... It's often known as a caipfruta.
Caipfruta.
Caipfruta. I mean, people will say, I'm sure there are still plenty of menus that say kiwi caipirinha and strawberry caipirinha, and they get away with it because it's not like somebody's going around rapidly and checking for this stuff. I've seen plenty of those here in the city. But I do like that they gave such care to their national cocktail that they put laws on the books about what it can and can't be.
Yeah, that seems to be like a persistent trait of Brazil, we're going to be really specific about this brand of stuff that's very Brazilian. They have the rules for cachaça. Why not have the rules for caipirinha?
Yeah. One of the reasons that's given as to why it took cachaça a long time to get on the international stage is because Brazil has a lot of poverty. There hasn't been focus on this. They haven't had the companies haven't had the money to throw behind their brands. And it's only recently, with the kind of expanding understanding of cocktail culture and that craze, that we've brought it in. But to just sort of use that to capitalize on it and make it an identifiable, necessary cocktail for bartenders to know and be able to make, that has to use Brazilian cachaça, like that has to be made well. I think that's great. That's a smart way of like codifying, getting your national spirit play on the international marketplace.
Yeah, absolutely. So you might think that if the caipirinha is Brazil's national drink and cachaça is their national spirit, that that's what they drink the most. But surprisingly, the beverage most consumed annually by Brazilians is actually beer.
Yeah, and very specific types of beer as well.
Yes, it's got to be very particular. They got the tastes.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of this comes from necessity. Like, they like their beer really, really cold. Mm. This is when we talked about doing this episode. One of the few things that I knew going into it was like, oh, cold beer. And that's because one of my regulars at my bar is Brazilian. And when I first met her, she asked me, and this is why she stuck in my mind, if my draft beer was, is it American cold? Is it European cold? Or is it Brazilian cold?
Ooh.
And I was like, Jesus, I don't know what that means, but I want to know. Please, please tell me what you mean by that. And she told me, like, well, we have the coldest beer. Brazil is the coldest beer in the world. That's how we drink our beer. So I will have some wine if your beer isn't Brazilian cold. And I was like, well, here, try a little bit and tell me. And she's like, oh, that's American cold.
Yeah.
That's like, oh, okay.
All right.
Well, get you some wine.
Yeah. She should just like text you when she's coming so you can just put a beer like on ice, just like pour it and like put the, have you ever done the, I mean, I don't know if this is very feasible for like actually when you're bartending, but the whole like the wet paper towel around the bottle or around the glass and put it in the freezer.
Well, this was draft beer. So it's hard to chill draft beer.
Unless you chill the glass and pour
it
into
it. We
have
chilled glasses. We pour into
good. But she didn't like that?
Even in a cold glass, it was not quite as cold.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, it was a high standard of coldness that she was expecting from her beer. But I mean, you can chill beer rapidly with that technique.
But it's not Brazilian cold.
I don't know. I really want to have a cold ass beer in Brazil. I hope I get to do that someday because I love cold beer. And the way that, like, to my understanding, it's like, well, 90% of the beer that is sold in Brazil is Pilsner style. And they do have a really active brewing culture. They have a lot of Brazilian national beers that are what people like to drink. It's not like a heavy import market. A lot of them even make it, or a lot of them are on the shelves in America. I mean, you know, I've seen Skol, Bohemia, Brahma, Serra Malta.
Oh, yeah, Brahma.
Like, yeah. And they're all like, not only are they Pilsner styles, but they're a little lighter and a little sweeter than what we're used to. But that makes sense because as things get colder, our palates change immensely with the temperature of whatever we're tasting.
Oh,
right. As things get colder, one of the big changes is we taste less sweetness. So if your style of drinking beer is incredibly cold, then it makes sense that you would like that beer a little sweeter than what the European style of Pilsner or the American style of Pilsner is. Because you're going to taste less sugar. It's the same idea as, like, if you ever had a frozen drink and you've let it melt and then you drink that liquid and it's just, like, sugar water. Like, what happened?
Yeah, no.
Like, it's just warmed up and your palate tastes more sugar.
Ah. Interesting. It's science again.
I love when science comes into this stuff.
Well, a little bit of history for the beer culture. The reason why beer is such a big deal in Brazil is because in the early 19th century, there was a huge influx of German immigrants. And so Yeah, they brought their love of beer. The first microbreweries in Brazil were established in the 1830s, which is pretty early. They actually have the second largest Oktoberfest in the world, in a city in southern Brazil called Blumenau. And that city is actually home to thousands of German descendants.
What a cool, very specific place to go for Oktoberfest.
Yeah.
Like, that means, you know, it's like, that sounds like one of those things that you want to do. I mean, even more so than, do I want to see Oktoberfest in Germany? I'm like, I don't know, maybe. Do I want to see it in Brazil? Yeah, I do.
Yes. Yeah.
I really do.
I definitely do.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. So wow. They drink a lot of beer. It's not all they drink, right?
No, they have a rapidly expanding palate for wine, industry around wine. Wine has been in Brazil for a long time. You know, you had German settlers. You also had Italians. Italian immigrants came heavily in the late 1800s, and they brought old world vines and their techniques with them. The thing that largely affected the wine development in Brazil was that it was a closed economy until the 90s. So they didn't really have a lot of competition. They just kind of, you know, they made their wine. This is what we had. Once that changed, you know, they're right on the border of Argentina. They had a lot of influx of other styles of wine, other countries' wine, that they sort of rapidly began upping their game of like wine production to compete with exterior markets. And I feel like that's every couple of years, you know, there's that new like, oh, you like wines from, you know, whatever, like you like Italian wines, well, I'm really into Argentinian wines. And that's like, mm-hmm. Oh, Brazilian wines. Mm. And so they're definitely like making a name for themselves very rapidly in the wine scene. The style, once again, it's kind of lighter and sweeter. It makes sense for the climate. But they mm-hmm. have a lot of common varietals. They grow really well and are produced really well in Brazil, like Merlots and Cabernets.
Oh.
Yeah. They also have lesser known, like, regional varietals that are worth investigating. But they really have an aggressive development and growing thirst for wine in Brazil.
Nice. I like that.
Yeah.
I like that there's so many different influences on Brazil, just like people coming. And I mean, I don't know, I guess there were several points in history that people just wanted to get to Brazil.
Well, it's that uncomfortable mix of like, I mean, when you start with colonization, you had people forcing their culture on people that already had culture.
Right.
But you know, then you have like the Germans, the Italians, other people coming here. It's just a big swath of land that, I don't know, you just have a lot of things mixing together. It's definitely a unique landscape of cultural identity.
Awesome.
So yeah, so we got beer, we got wine. When it comes to sort of Brazilian drinking customs and cultures, you know, a lot of the last few episodes we've done on those, there's a lot of codified ideas of how you drink socially and how you show respect with how you drink and how you interact with different kinds of people with how you drink. Brazil doesn't really have as much of that. It's a lot more chill. There are still like, I feel like it was a bit more familiar to me because it's a little bit more like, you know, in America we have customs and like traditions, but it doesn't really have like a set identity in our professional life. Mm-hmm. It's mainly centered around socialization and relaxation.
Yes.
So things are a little less codified. But I do like a lot of what they do. I agree with a lot of it. One thing that I came across is that cachaça, if you're offered it or if you order it, it's not really supposed to be taken as a shot. That kind of varies from country to country. You know, in some places, right, it would be rude to not finish your drink in one drink.
Right.
You know, in America, as much as we love our bourbon and prize it, taking a shot of really nice bourbon is still not seen as like, oh, you shouldn't do that. But I do kind of appreciate the like, no, cachaça is really nice.
Yeah.
Chill out.
Just enjoy it.
Take a sip.
just chill.
similarly, the drinking age is 18, but also not like crazy enforced. They're very strict about like their drunk driving legislation. Yeah. Is really intense, really heavily enforced. But as far as like, you know, the drinking age, it's not really a, like a lot of European cultures, it's just kind of not an issue as much as we have in our country.
Right, because they weren't like scolded like children for drinking and being drunk. They didn't have the temperance movement.
Weird and shame.
They don't have weird shame. They're not acting like rebellious teenagers like America is.
Just enjoy your drink.
They're acting like you're children 17? That okay. Like their parents trust them. That's how they behave.
I just love that. I really like that respect to like, we see children, but like on the verge of adulthood, where it's like, yeah, you can have a glass of wine with a meal. That's a big difference from, you know, getting to be a fresh 21-year-old in America, where it's like,
I'm gonna just drink everything for 5 years.
I'm gonna have shots until I'm dead.
Right? Like all the drinking I didn't do from the time I wanted to, I'm gonna do in one night. That's not always the best.
Yeah, no.
But yeah, definitely more lax about that. One of the sort of touch points of culture that I should say, a lot of these drinking cultures we talked about, I've experienced firsthand, which is really nice. So I feel like I can talk with some level of this research was more just like, oh, that sounds nice. I'd like to go there. Yeah. Oh, that's nice too. But the most popular place to go drink in Brazil is at botecos. Which the word comes from like the Spanish bodega and the Portuguese botica.
Oh.
And starts out just as much like, you know, here in New York, when you say bodega, you know what that means. It's a little store where you can find like basic sundries, food, drinks, necessities. Mm-hmm. And that's what that started out meaning. Over time, it evolved into being more of like a bar. It's usually like very simple. Outdoor seating is a big emphasis. Oh. Cheap drinks.
So it's like a dive bar.
Yeah, but there's always little food, you know, there's always snacks, there's always some tapas. So like, just sounds like a really like, that's exactly how I want to drink.
That sounds lovely.
Give me a little snack, give me a cheap drink. There's a term that comes up for like, I guess, how to refer to like the level of bar you're going to or boteco you're going to, which is pe sujo.
What does that mean?
Pe sujo, dirty foot.
What?
Which I was a little confused by the term, and then I looked it up. It's like how we say dirty spoon. It's like a diner. It's a dirty spoon.
Oh.
So basically it means it's a dive. It's you can expect cheaper than normal drinks, no frills.
Dirty foot.
I love that.
That's charming.
But yeah. So, you know, it's just really laid back, chill. Usually there's some outdoor element, place that you want to go look to drink. I mean, it kind of like, it came up in like a lot of cultural guides, like if you want to ask for where are good bars to go, ask for botecos. Like that's what you want to ask for. Also, the ones that put the word in their name are probably bougie and not to be trusted.
Oh, okay.
It's like saying, like, I guess in America, if a bar was like, I don't know, Taylor's Dive Bar, it's like, that's not a dive. You called it a dive. It's not a dive.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
That's a good, like, tourist hack for you.
There you go. Well, and also, you know, we talked about beer, but, like, how you drink it is pretty specific, too, because the temperature is so important. The way that beer is often sold at bars in Brazil is in, like, big, you know, 750 or, like, liter bottles, like, big bottles of beer.
Oh, so you share it with some friends.
You share. You don't want to like sit down at a table and order your own and be like, no, this is my giant beer, because it's not going to stay cold long enough for you to enjoy it the way you're supposed to enjoy it. And it's also rude. You should share your beer and you should be prepared to share beer.
Yeah. And if you don't, if you're not willing to share your beer, then your punishment is warm beer.
Which nobody likes. I think that's actually that's not true. There are styles of beer that are served
like
warm,
like English beer, or like no, that's true.
Yeah,
but not in Brazil. They like it cold.
No, and I like that this kind of is a thread that runs through all of their drinking cultures. It's like, look, it's hot here. We like cold things. It's hot here.
Come on, I get with it.
I get it. Yeah. As far as like little, you know, like toasts and traditions, The most common toast is Saúde, which is, you know, it's like salute, it's toast.
Because salute means like to your health, I think. I think it's like a one of those type cheers.
I think it all comes from like Latin salus or health.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So a lot of these trickle down from there. So it all, yes, I no, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's that's they all link back to your health.
Because drinking is healthy.
Well, it's, you know, it's you've for
got your health, your well-being.
Well, in that's this the case, it's definitely important to your health because there's a popular toast that it's said in Portuguese. I am not going to subject you all to that much of my attempt at Portuguese. But the translation is drinking without toasting, 7 years without orgasms. Toasting without drinking, 7 years without fucking.
Oh!
So I guess it is to your health to take a toast and take a drink.
Okay. Those are, damn, Brazil, you got some rules.
And this is another one of those, you know, you want to, when you toast, you want to look everybody in the eye.
Uh-huh.
You also definitely, you want to take a drink before putting your glass back down.
That makes sense.
Yeah. One of the customs that I stumbled across was a sedierde. It's a nightcap. More or less. But the way it's usually utilized is, let's say you're out with friends. I wish we would adopt this in America because it sounds so pleasant. Instead of saying, oh, you know what, I'm good, I'm gonna go, it's sort of a joint, like, let's get one last drink in the bill and then we'll leave. So it's kind of like that, like the combination of, we know this is our last drink to have together, so let's recognize that and like one more drink and then we're gonna get the bill at the same time. That's something that I've experienced as a bartender, like a lot of people asking for their last round and the bill at the same time.
Uh-huh.
And as a baby bartender, it always confused me because I'd be like, wait, did I misunderstand you? Because what if you get to the end of that drink and you decide you want another one and I've given you the bill and that's rude? Because, you know, in America, it's very much like if you give somebody the bill before they ask for it, it's a big no. It's rude. That's bad service. You've just told me you want me to leave. So anytime somebody asks for the bill when they've still got food or they just ordered a drink, there's always a part of me that's like, should I do it right away? Over time, I've realized that like if somebody asks for that culturally, that's a thing in a lot of the world.
Yeah. And it kind of makes sense that, like, you know, we know that we're going to leave after this, and also this is a way of holding ourselves to it. Like,
yeah, yes,
this last one, I promise.
I think it makes it a less stressful, much more pleasant. Like, okay, we're gonna cherish this. It's our last drink. We have paid the tap, so we're not gonna get any more.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So
yeah, that's nice.
That little nightcap is the nightcap I got to this. Little discussion.
That was nice. That was a nice little mental trip to Brazil.
I mean, not that it's really, I know we were talking about this a bit. I don't want us to imply that it's a getaway to our current situation, because they're dealing with a lot of the same stuff.
Yeah, it's eerily similar to the United States. Listeners, you might have already been familiar with this, with the situation with Brazil and their president being kind of like, and he has been called the Brazilian Trump, and they just like, I mean, it's really uncanny how much like him coming into power mirrored the way that our president in the United States got there, where people were just really disillusioned with politicians in general, and then like it just so happened that the worst person possible was the one that came up, and he's been really, a lot of Brazilians are really unhappy, as they should be, with how dangerously he's been just like, basically, he's not taking the pandemic seriously and encouraging other people to not take it seriously, and it's very dangerous. So we just wanted to, we did want to talk about cachaça and drinking culture, but we also want to, you know, kind of extend some love to the people of Brazil, and we feel your pain. We're going through, I mean, yeah, we're going through something really similar. So I think there's some solidarity between the people of the United States and the people of Brazil right now.
I guess it's a good time to, if you don't know how to make a caipirinha, learn how, and buy some cachaça and just drink a lot of it.
Drink a lot. just drink a lot and then keep drinking a lot. And
yeah,
If that helps. If that helps. You know,
that's,
I'm not going
to. I'm not trying to encourage people over imbibing. I'm just talking about the facts of my reality. Yep. That are, that's just kind of the two, time has no meaning anymore other than like, well, these are the hours that I'm actively trying not to drink to be a responsible human. And these are the hours where I go, fuck it.
Yeah, it's a strange thing we're going through right now, but we're going through it together.
All this together.
We're all in this together. One day I'll learn the rest of the words to High School Musical so I can sing it for you.
You know, I mean,
I
would love for you to sing so many songs to us. I don't know if that's on the list.
No. No, you don't want my Zac Efron impression?
I just might have other songs I put ahead of that. Your lovely singing voice. Just maybe your talents are used better in other venues than High School Musical.
Okay. All right.
You sing whatever you want. You know, I'm not going to. Yeah, fuck it. Look at the world. You fucking sing whatever you want right now. That's the last thing you should be worried about.
Okay. I'll practice for next week.
All right. Well, we're gonna at some point, we've got a rough live schedule figured out, so we will be making some drinks with Kishasa in the coming weeks for you. That video will be available.
It's gonna be fun. Join us for those.
I think it'll be cool. You know, I love Liz edits everything and does such a good job with it.
Thanks.
Has edited our videos so well. But in this circumstance, I think that this is a good alternative where we can both be together on the video.
That's what we want.
Yeah,
we want to be together and we want to be with y'all, so this will be a new kind of format, so you know, we'll see. You're gonna experience it for the first time with us. It's so special, but we'll tweet about it and we'll let you know in advance when that's gonna happen. I also want to say a shout out to all of our Patreon people. Thank you to all of you who have donated. Thanks to all of our new Patreon members and everybody who's upped their donations. That's really fucking cool. Thank you so much. And if you want to be one of our Patreon supporters, we will put that link in our show notes. Feel free to send us a booze-related question. And you've been hearing it. We do answer them eventually. So send those on over. And thank you so much to everyone who tweeted and retweeted about the show. Now more than ever, that's really helpful to get new people listening to it. It's really cool. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Neat Boozecast. Thank you to Absurdist for our wonderful theme music. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, you know, why not subscribe? Rate and give us a review if you like, or and whatever platform you're listening to, if you have the ability to give us a review or a rating or subscription, then go for it, because that'd be really super nice.
We appreciate it. Absolutely.
Yeah, so that's all I got.
All right, well, I have been Taylor Sproul,
and I've been Liz June,
and this has been
Neat.